Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
This is Horace Grant, a Jordan teammate. Not only a Jordan teammate, but a Jordan teammate who helped Mike win the first three rings. Horace is pissed. And Horace went on Cap and Company on ESPN 1000 in Chicago yesterday and absolutely unloaded on Jordan and the documentary. You see, Horace is pissed for a number of reasons, starting with Jordan swerving way out of his lane to say that Grant was the most or was the main source for Sam Smith's famous The Jordan Rules back in the day. To Horace Grant, that's definitely a reason to go.
Lie, lie, lie. If MJ had a grudge with me, let's settle it like, man, let's talk about it, or we can settle it another way. But yet and still, he goes out and put this lie out that I was the source behind. Sam and I have always been great friends. We're still great friends. But the sanctity of that locker room, I would never put anything personal out there. The mere fact that Sam Smith was an investigative reporter, that he had to have two sources, to write a book, I guess. Why would MJ just point me out?
All right, so Horace is not happy. Quote, why would MJ just point me out? He poses the question, and then he answers it himself.
I mean, it's only a grudge, man. I'm telling you, it was only a grudge. And I think he proved that during this so-called documentary when if you don't say something, if you say something about him, he's going to cut you off. He's going to try to destroy your character.
Quote, during this so-called documentary. Hey, look, I get that Jordan carries a grudge like nobody else, but why is he grudging so hard against a teammate? A teammate that he went to battle with. A teammate that helped him win three rings. And not just carrying a grudge, but according to Grant, carrying a grudge and looking to completely discredit the dude and destroy his character. So Horace is coming hard. That's good. That's strong. But it's about to get even better and even stronger. Grant says that Jordan is the last guy who should be calling anybody out.
My point is that he said I was a snitch. But yet and still, after 30 or 35 years, he brings up his rookie year going into one of his teammates' room, his former teammates' room, and seeing coke and weed and women. My point is, why in the hell did he want to bring that up? What's that got to do with anything? I mean, if you want to call somebody a snitch, that's a damn snitch right there.
Damn, Horace getting nice. He's got a hell of a point too, doesn't he? Like, I'm a snitch? Did you just call me a snitch? Actually, you're the damn snitch, Mike. After 5 weeks of Jordan hype, Horace Grant strapped on the goggles, grabbed a sledgehammer, and started doing work. You see, the way Grant sees it, Jordan's claiming that Grant is a snitch in a documentary series where he's doing snitching of his own. Like, you're lying about me being a snitch, and you're doing that after you've run an entire team under the bus for something that happened a decade and a half before the season that is supposed to be the focus of the doc. You're saying that I went to the media with private information about the team, yet you're sitting on camera running your mouth on private information about the team. Like, you're wanting to accuse me of airing dirty laundry, but you're doing the exact same thing about a team that had nothing to do with the actual team in the series. And you're doing it to get some run for your doc and make yourself look good. Like, I think Horace has a really good question. Why go there? Why tell everyone about the drugs and the women that your teammates had in their hotel rooms nearly four decades ago? Why do that? Other than to have a line or a soundbite to promote the doc and to remind everybody how great you are and how jacked up the Bulls were when you arrived and how much credit you deserve for turning the franchise around. It's a hell of an interview now that Horace did. And he wasn't done either. After absorbing some shots during the series, he was on top of Jordan, and he was landing hammer fists. And in case you didn't notice, Grant did not think too much of the series. It lost, at least not in the sense that it's an accurate record of what actually went down.
I would say, you know, entertaining, but we know who was there as teammates that about 90% of it was, I don't know if I can say it on air, but BS in terms of the realness of it. You know, as I stated the other day, that it wasn't real because a lot of things that he said to some of his teammates that his teammates went back at him, but all of that was kind of edited out of the documentary, if you want to call it a documentary.
If you want to call it a documentary. In particular, Grant was calling BS on this notion that Jordan's teammates never pushed back. The way Horace tells it, guys did push back. Ask Grant, the guys who pushed back did not make it into the dock. And the only guys who didn't push back were the ones who couldn't, and those were the guys that Jordan went after the most.
He felt that he could dominate me, but that was sadly mistaken. Because, you know, whenever he went at me, I went at him right back, you know. But in terms of Will Perdue, Steve Kerr, and the young man Scott Burrell, I mean, that was heartbreaking, you know, to see a guy, a leader, to go at those guys like that. I understand in terms of practicing, you know, you get, you have a push and shove there, here and there, but outright punching and things of that nature and calling them the B's and the H's, you know, that wasn't called for.
And Horace is putting it all out there. He's holding nothing back. He's covering everything. Then he was asked about that story that Jordan had told a flight attendant not to give him a meal after he thought that Horace had a bad game. Grant said that some of that happened, but not the way everybody thinks.
I mean, anybody knows me as a rookie that if anybody, I mean, comes up and try to snatch my food away, I'm going to do my best to beat their ass. And believe me, back then I could have took MJ in a heartbeat. Yes, it's true that he told the flight attendant, well, don't give him anything because he played like crap. And I went right back at him. I said some choice words that I won't repeat on here, but I said some choice words and stood up. If you want it, you come and get it. And of course, you know, he didn't move. He was just barking. But that was the story.
So who do you believe? I mean, that is strong. According to Grant, not only did MJ try to deny him his food, but when Grant got into him about it and threatened to bust his ass if he tried to take any food off his plate, Jordan didn't do anything. According to Horace, he was all talk. If true, that actually makes Jordan look even worse than the original story. Bad enough to try to deny a teammate food after a tough game, but to do it and then not back it up when he calls you out. I mean, does that make you a bully or a punk or both? Again, it is a he said thing. But after 5 weeks of Jordan getting his say, Grant wants to make sure that he gets his. And he had even more to say about the food on the plane.
But anybody knows me, where I come from and what I stand for. Come on, man. There's nobody in this earth will ever come and try to take food off my plate and not get their rear end beaten.
He's fired up. He's channeling some Lamar Thomas.
That's what
I'm
talking about.
He's about to get into an elevator.
You come into our house, you should get your behind kicked.
You come out on my plane and you try and lift food off my plate, you're going to get your ass kicked. He's channeling some Lamar Thomas, and he's about to get into an elevator or go down the aisle of the plane. And he still wasn't done talking about the airplane food incident. He had more when he was part of a Zoom call with Ron Harper, Bill Cartwright, and Craig Hodges, sponsored by BetOnline AG. Quote, let me clear something up about this food thing. Did he try to take my food? I would have beat his ass. Guys, you come back and you try to take my food, I would have whipped his ass. There wouldn't be no Air Jordans right now. It wouldn't be no 6 championships. I guarantee you that. So finally, what Horace is saying, in case you're not picking up on what he's doing, you want to take my food? Come and get it, tough guy. You can get this tray of airplane food, and then you can get these hands. Capital One knows life does not alert you about your credit card. Hey, couch surfers, we've got nonstop tunes to keep you rocking while you work. Oh, and Colleen. Yes, you, Colleen with a K. Your free trial of Movie Plus ends tomorrow, and your card may be charged. Do you want to continue or do you want to cancel? Sweet. So, meet Eno, the Capital One assistant. Eno looks out for surprise charges, like when free trials expire, and helps you if you need to fix them. Eno. Another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you are not. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Limitations apply. Steve Clifford. Steve, it is so good to have you back. Before we get into anything else, let me first ask you, how are you doing in the middle of this pandemic, Steve?
Hanging in there, Jim. I think like everybody, just trying to, you know, find a rhythm and a routine to the day and, you know, stay safe. I mean, so far, so good.
You know, speaking of which, in terms of finding a rhythm and a routine for the day, Steve, there really is no such thing as normal right now. So what does a normal day look like for you these days?
Well, you know, trying to get some study done of our team, of, you know, possible opponents, you know, if or when we're able to get back. You know, I think like everybody else, you know, my week is also the Zoom calls. You know, I have a call every day, every week with, you know, with our management group, and then, you know, 2 calls every week with our staff. And I kind of build everything around that. And then, you know, trying to touch base with the players so that, you know, able to communicate with them as often as I can.
We're talking to Steve Clifford. In fact, these are all the things I wanted to ask you about. Like, if you're watching a lot of tape and you're giving members of your staff different projects or components of the team to analyze, you're doing your Zoom call. What has the experience been like overall, and how much have you learned about your team during this process, because the process is so different?
Yeah, it's almost been, Jim, like to me, like a summer off season in that way. I've got a very experienced staff, so I'm fortunate, and we've done a bunch of projects. We've had a couple guest speakers. Actually, Coach Izzo spoke to us last week, and it was great. Like I said, we've done some kind of pre-scouts on potential postseason opponents if we are able to come back. But the majority of it has been studying our team, what we, you know, where we're at, and, you know, in all phases of the game. And again, if we are able to come back, what are the 2 or 3 things that we can hopefully do so our team can play as well as we can going forward?
Steve Clifford joining us. One thought about Coach Izzo. Unbelievable coach, great leader, great motivator. I'm curious, why did you pick him to talk to your guys? And then what was his message to the pro players?
Yeah, he spoke to our he actually spoke to our staff.
Got it.
I have two assistants here. Steve Hetzel has been with me for a few years and is terrific. And then Stan Heath, who's our G League coach, is also a terrific coach, who both worked at Michigan State and both have good relationships with Coach Izzo. So I've gotten to know him a little bit through them over the years. Actually, we laughed. The last time I was on the phone with him, it was 4 or 5 years ago, and we were talking about the draft. And we went through some different players, and he said, "Well, Steve, I will tell you this. If I'm picking, the guy that everybody's going to overlook this year is Devin Booker, and he's the guy that has star potential." So I guess a lot of us didn't get that one right, but if Coach Izzo would have been in the NBA, he would have.
I got it. Steve Clifford joining us. Great point. So the team, Steve, was able to open up its facility last Thursday to allow limited voluntary workouts. Does that feel like a glimmer of hope in terms of the season resuming?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, we're all hopeful. I know for our guys, they were so excited to get back in there. And we've had most of our guys have been in there. As you know, the head coaches can't be involved in that. You're able to designate six assistants. And our strength coaches are in there, physical therapists, trainers. So it's a combination of on the floor, the guys that need physical therapy are able to get that and then work in the weight room. And it's definitely a great starting point. Because, again, as you know, guys are not used to, you know, all of these guys have gone around 8 or 9 weeks without being in a gym in a ball. So there's a conditioning part, and then there's obviously just a basketball rhythm part that they have to get back to.
And, Steve, what about you? I mean, you're a basketball lifer. What's it been like? How challenging has it been not to have any practices or games for 2 months now for you?
Yeah, it's been hard. And that's why, as a staff, what we've done, like I think most people have, is try to treat it as much like an off season as possible without the individual workouts. And it's been different for sure. And then the other part, which I think is a parallel for everybody in every profession, it's just where there's no definitive starting date for when we're going to be able to get back and when we're going to get started again. So, you know, there's the unknown, you know, which we're all dealing with.
See, I love that point you just made, that like for any given profession, like I love talking to people like you because like we're all dealing with this. We're all trying to figure out exactly what our rhythm is, what our routine is, how we can somehow turn this negative into a positive, how we can capitalize where we go from this. This is really interesting to me. In terms of the season itself, I mean, we're talking about a team that battled injuries throughout the season, but you're still in position for a playoff spot if and when the season does resume. I understand it has not been a perfect year so far, but what do you make of the way your guys dealt with the challenges that were put in front of them?
Oh, I was really proud of the way that our guys hung in there and the way we were playing at the end. You know, we lost Jonathan Isaac and Al-Farouq Aminu, who are two, you know, terrific defenders, and both guys who play the same position. So when you lose the guy that was the starter and then his backup, obviously that's a big void to fill. And we had some other injuries too, like everybody does. But our best basketball we played at the last stretch after the All-Star break, we had improved a great deal offensively. And we'd also played, I believe, the third or fourth most difficult schedule. So we had won 8 out of 12. We had won 3 in a row all on the road. And we had 4 of the next 5 at home. And 4 of those games were going to be against teams who weren't fighting for playoff spots. So we had put ourselves in good spot when the season was halted. And but I was proud. You know, we made good progress, particularly offensively, and hopefully we can come back and try to recapture some of that.
I would even add to that, during that 12-game stretch, you led the league in scoring and assists. You were second in field goal percentage, so the team was playing really, really well. There are a number of guys I could single out before you leave, but I've got to pick my spots. Markelle Fultz was playing the best basketball of his career before the stoppage. What's it been like working with him, and how far has he come since he first arrived?
He's come. He's playing at a level that if anybody were here from the time he arrived, because of the injuries, I don't think any of us could have hoped that he'd be playing this well this soon. But, you know, last year, Jim, middle of July, you know, he was shooting free throws, you know, still had the, you know, and he still does. He still has some issues with his shoulder. He has some knee issues and he has some wrist issues. And he is a throwback kid. He loves basketball. He's obviously a terrific athlete, but he plays to me like a DC point guard. He's tough. He's smart. He knows the game and he's a very committed player. So we're lucky to have him. And, you know, he's made great gains already.
Magic head coach Steve Clifford joining us for another moment or so. And, of course, in the absence of live sports, The Last Dance has been a huge focus of interest. You worked with Michael Jordan in Charlotte. So what was your biggest takeaway from your time with him?
I think a lot of what everybody saw in The Last Dance. In fact, I just had a long conversation with Aaron Gordon about this, is you can see, to me, from a basketball perspective, obviously he's great player, but to me it's the details. And I love the clips for young players of him talking to one of his teammates on the bench about a coverage, you know, or even in the last, I think it was the 9th or 10th episode, where there was a timeout, and I think Phil Jackson said, "Hey, let's switch it," and Michael said, "Let me defend it this way." And to me, working with him, which, you know, I enjoyed greatly, but he is a nuts and bolts basketball guy, but he's into, again, the details, the execution part of the game, both offensively and defensively. And those were what the majority of our conversations were like, which obviously is unique from an owner.
Steve, one last thought. You also work with Kobe Bryant when you were with the Lakers, so I know that you've touched on this, but how similar were the two of them when it comes to their heads for the game?
There's a great parallel. I mean, Kobe was constantly looking for an edge, you know, or in love to talk basketball. I can actually remember, I've told the story to a few people, still during training camp, one day after practice, we get done practice, and I was just out watching some of the guys do their routines after practice, and he had gone into lift, and all of a sudden I was beckoned.
Beckoned.
he sent a guy out to get me to come in, and he was lifting, and he said, "Hey, just walk around here with me. I want to talk about some of these Van Gundy things you guys used to do against me during the years." And as he lifted, it was probably like a 40-minute lift, and it was he and I and the strength coach, and we just talked about schemes, and he was one of those guys that if I said, you know, we would come from the top, and he would listen and then say, "Did you ever come from a different angle?" Or, you know, very similar to Michael. I mean, loved to talk basketball, loved the nuances, and he loved coverages, schemes. You know, I know Michael would talk about, within the triangle, manipulating the offense, and it was the first thing that I learned from Kobe. That year, you may remember, we were running a lot of the Princeton offense early in the year, and Kobe, this is a great story, Jim. I got hired in early August, and in the month of August, Kobe used to go in the gym every morning early with Eddie Jordan. I used to go in and help rebound from 7 to 8 to learn the different cuts in the Princeton offense, and he wanted to go early so the gym was quiet. And by the time we started camp, I remember Steve Nash saying to me, "How long has he been doing this stuff?" Like, he knew, you know, he knew the offense, and you know, one of the many reasons, you know, for his greatness.
It's an amazing story, Steve. Like, for instance, was fatigue never an issue? Was he just wired differently? How could Kobe go that hard, that long, every day on that little sleep, and it didn't really seem to affect him?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to be around, you know, a lot of, like, really terrific players. I feel blessed, you know, I mean, I was in Houston with Tracy and Yao, and with the Knicks with Allen Houston and Spree. You know, Dwight here with Rashard Lewis and those guys when I was an assistant. And then on that Laker team, Steve Nash and Powell and Dwight again. He's unlike anybody, you know, that I've ever been around. Just, again, his passion, I think, would be the number one thing I would say. His passion. He was relentless in his drive to get better and try to make our team win every day.
Steve, one last thought. I could just listen to your stories for hours. You mentioned Dwight Howard. I got to ask you this. Did you foresee him reinventing himself the way he has with the Lakers, accepting the role that he has, fit in the way he has, and really completely resurrecting himself the way he has?
I can't say I would have predicted it, but I'm happy for him. And I would say, along with this, Jim, is physically, and this is what I don't think people have gotten to see. I know from having him, you know, the 1 year we did in Charlotte, he has slimmed down, totally changed the way he lifts and his diet. And, you know, he's had to just change his habits, you know, his eating habits, his diet, and his lifting so drastically to be able to keep playing. And to get back to this level, I'm really happy for him.
I don't think that's easy to do either. It's not as simple as just throwing the switch. I agree with you. Orlando Magic head coach Steve Clifford, my guest. Steve, I hate to let you go, but I know I have to let you go. It is so good to have you back on the show. I appreciate the conversation. I appreciate the relationship. Stay safe, Steve, and I hope we have basketball soon so you and I can continue this conversation.
Great. Thank you, Jim. Anytime. I appreciate it.
Jordan portrayed himself as a tough leader. Grant obviously didn't buy that. He essentially made the point that Jordan was a bully. As Grant said, he would take runs at guys like Will Perdue, Scott Burrell, Steve Kerr, guys that he could take runs at because that's what a bully does. That's the definition of a bully. Go at people who you know will not come back at you. But according to Horace Grant, if you challenge Mike, he'd back down. So Jordan would go after guys that he could beat up and he'd back down from guys that he couldn't, according to Grant. And that's not just Grant talking. Check this detail from Jackie McMullen back in 2012 about Robert Parrish and his season with the Bulls. Quote, in one of his first practices with the Bulls, Parrish botched one of the plays and was amused to find Jordan jawing at him just inches from his face. I told him, I'm not as enamored with you as these other guys. I've got some rings too. At that point, he told me, I'm going to kick your ass. I took one step closer and said, no, you really aren't. After that, he didn't bother me. End quote. It's pretty badass from the chief. I'm not sure what's the better line. I'm not as enamored with you as these other guys. I've got some rings too. Or when Jordan threatened to kick his ass and told him so, I'm going to kick your ass. He took a step closer and Parrish said, quote, no, you really aren't. But back to Horace and the punches he's throwing now, reminding everybody that Mike will just break you off and X you out, no matter who you are or how close you've been, if you do not bow down to the king. He mentions Charles Barkley is a prime example of that.
I mean, you know, Charles Barkley, they've been friends for over 20, 30 years, and he said something about Michael's management with the Charlotte Bobcats or the Charlotte Hornets. And then they haven't spoken since then.
Credit Cap and Company, ESPN 1000 Chicago. If that's really how that went down, it would seem like Jordan can dish it, but he can't take it. Not if Charles Barkley, a friend for decades, is just doing his job. And by the way, is correct in pointing out that Jordan has not had much success as a team executive or owner. And then if Jordan cut him out, just cut him out, broke him off for saying that, that lends credence to what Horace is saying. I mean, whatever happened to the guy who was getting all choked up when he talked about leadership and winning at all costs? What happened to the guy who said,
winning has a price. And leadership has a price. So I pulled people along when they didn't want to be pulled. I challenge people when they don't want to be challenged.
That's Mike in the dock. What happened to the guy who said, I wasn't doing it for them? Or I wasn't doing it for me, I was doing it for them. This is the same guy who was saying, quote, my mentality was to go out and win at any cost. If you don't want to live that regimented mentality, then you don't need to be alongside of me because I'm going to ridicule you until you get on the same level with me. And if you don't get on the same level, then it's going to be hell for you, end quote. Except when Barkley ridiculed him to level up as an executive and an owner, Jordan was not hearing it. Apparently, sometimes when you challenge Mike the way he challenged everybody else, Mike doesn't want to be challenged, apparently. And the thing about Horace was not just pissed on his own behalf, he was pissed for Scottie Pippen as well. Because aside from Jordan giving some praise to Pippen early in the series, most of the talk about Pippen was about all of his low moments.
I have never seen a quote-unquote a number two guy decorated as Scottie Pippen portrayed so badly in terms of the migraine, in terms of the 1.6 or 7 second selfish. I have never seen this in all of my life. In the respect of Pitt was out there, I think in game 6, could barely walk, getting knocked down on his back, trying to do whatever he could to help that team. And my point is, why was that 1.6 or 7 seconds in the documentary, so-called documentary, about Pip? MJ wasn't even on the team. Why was that in there? We handled that year fairly well as a team. Pip knew that he was wrong for doing it. But yet and still, we went after the game. Bill stood up, said we had to say, Bill Cartwright. And then we handled it. It was over. It was over. We go on to take the Knicks to 7 games. So, I mean, it was over. Why bring that up? That's my question to everybody out there who's listening.
That's Horace Grant, and it's a fair question. If the series is about the final season, the so-called last dance, why was something from 4 years earlier included? Something that Jordan was not even there for. He was off playing baseball. That didn't concern him. He wasn't on that team. And as Horace said, the team handled it. And that Pippen knew he was wrong. Even though Pippen did say for the documentary that he would not change anything. Anyway, if this was about Michael Jordan's version of the final season, why was something that did not involve Michael Jordan, why was that given so much time in the doc? Why was it so important to Jordan to bring up the lowest point of Pippen's career? And if you want to say, yeah, well, because that was important, believe me, he left out a lot of important things. So why was it important to him to put that in there? As Jackie McMullen wrote earlier this month, people close to Pippen say that he's been wounded and disappointed by how he was portrayed in that documentary. Yeah, I can see why. One of the single greatest players to ever play the game. And in a series that's supposed to sum up everything, and much of the focus on him is about all of his faults. Yes, Jordan did call him the best teammate he ever had. He said that he could not have reached that level without Pippen. Right. Tell me something we didn't all know. It's like saying the sky is blue, water is wet. It's a fact. Everybody knows this. Nobody would debate the idea that Pippen was the best teammate Jordan ever had. Pippen is one of the best players ever. Period. Nobody would debate the fact that Pippen played a massive, massive role in winning those 6 rings. Except Jordan also called Pippen selfish for how he handled his foot injury, something that Steve Kerr and Phil Jackson both disagreed with. Jordan still seems to be questioning Pippen's migraine against Detroit and challenging his toughness on that, which honestly is pretty weak, really, on Jordan's part. Here's another fact. Bulls players love Scotty. They loved him more than they love Mike. One guy after another has talked about how much they love Scotty. You don't hear guys saying that about Jordan. Maybe that bothers Jordan. I understand. Leadership comes with a price. I understand. Mike wants your respect. Mike didn't want to be loved. I don't know. Maybe it bothers him that everybody goes out of their way to say how much they love playing with Scotty. And people aren't saying that about him. Maybe. Or maybe he has an axe to grind with everybody and wants to point out how much tougher and how much more of a perfect teammate he was. Maybe that bothers him. I don't really know. Or maybe, as Grant implies, maybe he's just a bully. Maybe he's using this series to continue bullying guys. I don't know. I don't know, but this much is clear. Not everybody is happy with the doc. And it's not just the guys that Mike went up against, like Isaiah. It's also the guys he played with, like Horace. And although Scotty hasn't said for the record, Jackie McMullen says people close to Scotty have said he's disappointed and hurt by the doc. We are joined by PJ Fleck. PJ, there is only one way that you and I can start off our conversations. And even though we're catching up during a really unusual time, I do have to ask yet again, how are you doing today, PJ?
I'm doing elite, Jim. Appreciate you having us back on the show.
It's good to have you back on the show, and I knew that would be the answer. Let me ask you this. I think a lot of us are asking this question of ourselves. How are you staying elite right now under these circumstances?
Well, I think creativity. I think that's the name of the game right now. You know, we all have the same type of rules and stipulations of what we can and cannot do. but finding creative ways. You know, everybody's got virtual visits. Everybody's got the recruiting part. Everybody's got our position meetings, team meetings, virtual voiceovers that you're doing with your team. But what do those look like, and how are those being run? And I think it's just brilliant of how our coaches have been able to do it. We have a very creative staff, a very youthful staff. I mean, I'm the fourth oldest guy now on my staff, and I'm only 39. And it's just they're working really hard. And we were on a quarterbacks meeting this morning, and it was just so refreshing to see how Coach Sanford was doing it. Not only just the football part, but the, all getting to know each other and keeping everybody connected during the time that we're all going through right now.
We were talking to PJ Fleck. You know, PJ, obviously this is a time of pain, a time of suffering as a result of the coronavirus, but can you also make the argument for being able to come out of this better, stronger, and even more compassionate than before?
Yeah, who's to say the new norm, right? I know people hate hearing the new norm, but who's to say the new norm can't be better? Is it going to be a little awkward, going to be a little tough for a while? Is it going to be hard to get used to? I'm sure it will be. But at the end of the day, hopefully we can get back to some type of normalcy when we continue to go back from this. But we're all going to learn from this. You know, who's to say that the lessons and the things we've been taught from this, what we've learned as a country, what we've learned, how we can do things virtually, can't make our world better. And we can add to what we had before. But, you know, my wife said it best, you know, when this thing started, my wife said that I feel like, you know, Mother Nature's told us all to kind of go to our room and think about what we've done. And she was 100% right. Because when you think about this, this is a big, tragic time for so many people, whether that's health or whether that's finances, whether it's job securities. I mean, our new norm was just washed away. Our old norm was just washed away. And with it, a lot of people's jobs and dreams and futures. And it's tough with that. But we all have to kind of look at, you know, what's really important to us. And, you know, this has given all of us a time, about 8 weeks, to reflect, spend time with family, really evaluate how what our lives look like and how they could be in the future. So I do think that there always is silver lining. I do always think that the glass is half full, and I do think we can come back better from this than we were in the past and take all the lessons we've learned and apply them to not only the old norm, but what the new norm is going to look like.
PJ Fleck is joining us. You know, a really interesting response. I wonder, when you mentioned that maybe we learned some things about ourselves where virtually we can do certain things that maybe we didn't do in the past, I wonder, PJ, like, for instance, you can't speak for every coach, but you can speak for yourself and your staff. Do you think that maybe you might work in a different manner now based on what you've gone through, or as somebody who cares so much and works so hard, frankly, do you think you might go back to doing it the way you always have? And will most people approach it that way?
Well, I think there's going to be a combination, Jim. I really believe that. I mean, I've learned so much about the virtual world through Zoom. I mean, my goodness, Zoom has changed our entire life, right? FaceTime's one thing, but Zoom, if everybody together. And I think there's times, you know, we're talking the coaching profession, there's so much time away from your family. There's so much time on the road. There's so much time that you're not with each other. And I think this virtual world has really been able to make me, as a head coach, reevaluate my entire schedule for the entire year for our coaching staff. We can get a lot done from the virtual side, plus get a lot of the work done from being in person, but we can make it maybe all work, especially with our family lives. So there's a lot of things we can do virtually. There's things you can do when the players are away. I think it's really unique, and I think we're going to be applying a lot of lessons we learned from this as we move into the future, and that's what we're going to take from it.
PJ Fleck is joining us. You know, I mentioned what an amazing year you had last year, and the internal expectations, it seems to me, are not going to change as a result of a season like that, even as good as it was, but the external expectations certainly will. So how do you approach that? Do you shut out those expectations, or do you learn to work with them and use them to your advantage and lean into them?
Yeah, first and foremost, nobody's going to put more pressure on our team than us. Nobody's going to put more pressure on me than me. Nobody's going to put more pressure on our players than our players. And we're at a point now where we consider ourselves a player-led team. You know, bad teams, nobody leads. Average teams, coaches lead. Elite teams, players lead. And we felt like we got to that point last year where our players really took over. I mean, we have 5 4-star recruits on our entire football team. And we're going against teams that have, you know, 50 and 58 and coming out with some victory. So we knew we had to be this player-led team because the expectations were internal. You know, we were picked 6 in the West last year. So the external expectation, there was nothing, but we had high standards of ourselves. That will never change. But our players are dealing with something that this year is a little bit different because there is that external expectation. And the kind of the visual theme for the year is windows, because we can look out and see whatever we want in the window, but now people are looking in our windows and know what we're doing. They're studious in the off season. You're not going to surprise anybody anymore. So the external expectations are really shared with our players. I always share the outside with them. We want to be an internal out, inside out program where we change the way people feel about us, not the outside changes us. We want our culture on the inside to affect the world, not the world to affect us. So we want to make sure that we dissect all that. So we're very open. We're very honest. We had internal expectations last year. We have them this year. But being picked from the external part this year is going to be a little bit different for our players. So what we've been able to do is be able to give them those external expectations, talk to them about those things, and let our culture process it.
Minnesota head football coach P.J. Fleck joins us for a few more moments. See, when you talk about expectations and pressure, you go back to before that Penn State game last year, you had everybody write down on a piece of coal about the pressure, what they felt, and what they had overcome. And then before that game, you reached into that bucket of carbon and you pulled out a diamond. It's an amazing speech for those who have not seen it. How do you as a program then transfer that pressure into diamonds? Like, is it just a matter of showing up and being consistent, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, the actual slogan for the year is do it better for longer. You know, last year was find ways to do things smarter, not harder. This year is better for longer. You know, the two games we lost, Iowa, Wisconsin, we were consistent, but we weren't consistent enough. And that's where we need to be able to get back to. You know, this whole pandemic's going to be able to change a lot of things for a lot of people, but pretty much everybody's on the same page. I mean, when you look at it, we're all dealt the same type of card where we couldn't have access to our players. So the most mature football teams will come out of this ahead. And what do I mean by mature? When doing what you have to do becomes doing what you want to do. You know, there's so many things our players are going to have to do to come back, whether we get 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 4 weeks to get them acclimated before a season, if there is a season. So the teams that have been doing what they're supposed to do, academically, athletically, socially, spiritually, nutrition, weight room, football, the people who have been doing what they're supposed to do are going to have a huge advantage when we come back because they'll be able to pick up where they left off, not necessarily have to, you know, rebuild themselves. And so I think that's where we find that we trust our football team, love our football team, and know that when they come back, they'll be ready to roll.
So, PJ, finally, how do you consistently get anybody, much less a bunch of 17 to 22-year-olds, to do something or make something that they have to do, something they want to do? Because I think right there lies one of the secrets to life in and of itself. How do you convince people to do that and think of it that way and change their mindset?
Two things. One, cultural sustainability, you know, having the same culture over a long period of time where they can build within the culture. And then finding cultural ways to teach lifetime lessons. You know, we're all educators. We're all teachers in the football department. I mean, we teach football, but yes, we're teaching more life than we are football, especially in our program. This is a life program, not a football program. And so for us, it's finding those cultural ways to teach the normal lifetime lessons that you're teaching the same things almost every single year. But you're doing it in a way that every student athlete can relate to. You know, it's always like when I was back teaching sixth grade elementary school, you got 35 sixth graders who all learn 35 different ways. And you have, as an educator, you have to make sure every single one of those people who learn differently, who have a different range, who all, you know, whether it's audio, visual, whether they have to learn by touch, you're applying all of that to your daily lessons. And it's the same thing in college coaching, in my opinion. Whether you're teaching X's and O's, or whether you're teaching life, you've got to find those cultural ways that are really going to give those players that aha moment, I got it, based on their life. You know, and I've always used the example, if you're still talking about Michael Jordan and Larry Bird as a rivalry, those kids don't get it. Now, with, the last dance, they probably now know, but you've got to use things in their life, like Kanye and Drake, to be able to give them, oh, I know what that rivalry's like. So it's those types of things, you know, whether it's daily, weekly, monthly, or yearly, that continue to build within your program, but also separate from things you've done in the past.
So finally, I'm so glad you brought that up because I was thinking about it as you and I were talking, and I wasn't sure whether or not to bring it up because I didn't want it to come off the wrong way. I mean, in terms of football, PJ, obviously, I mean, you're going to dominate that aspect of your coaching and your teaching, and I don't want to sell that. I don't want to short sell that in any way, but I was going to ask, because we're talking about so many things that are not football related, how much of what you're coaching and teaching is about process and culture and mindset and discipline as opposed to just pure football?
Well, it's a combination of all of it, but I think, you know, your core values, you know, we have what we call the hyperculture, right? The HYPRR. So the how is the people. Then you have yours is the vision. Then you've got the P is the process, which is the work of everything, which all spells hype, right? So the people, the vision, and the work, it's either real or it's fake, period. Whether it's football, whether it's life, whether you're being taught something, everything there is prior to a result. That first R is a result. Then you're going to get data. That's what results are. And we value them so much in our society that everything's poured into that. But it really should be poured in the people, the right people that you have inside the organization, and then the vision, and then a process of that work, and then you're going to get a result. And how you respond to that really is a difference maker. So I would think, you know, we are football coaches, and we do a ton of football, just like everybody else. But the football fits in the culture. And so the football doesn't come before anything else. It's all in almost the same because there's a high standard of what our culture dictates. And whether that's academically, athletically, socially, and spiritually, because, you know, we had the greatest season in Gopher history, one of them, right? I mean, 11 wins and, you know, the first time in 116 years. But we also had a 3.21 GPA, which is the highest in the history of the school, right? So they go hand in hand. You can't be elite in one area of your life and not elite in another area of your life. You're either elite or you're not. And so it's all intertwined, one, with how we coach, because the way we teach and the way we coach our X's and O's is, again, fits within our culture, right? We have to maximize that teachability. So I probably didn't answer your question, but it's all intertwined. If I give you a percentage, I don't even know what the percentage would be, but, you know, we're football coaches. We are, but we're more life coaches than we are football coaches, and everything fits into this puzzle because inevitably, if you're just putting football above everything else, eventually that's going to wear off. Your players are going to see that, and it's going to be more of a business than, you know, this true fun, exciting experience that they want to be at. And I think that sometimes we lose sight of that.
And to answer your question, yes, you did answer my question. I'm glad I asked you. He is the head coach of the Minnesota Golden Gophers. He is entering his fourth year with Minnesota, already a Big Ten Coach of the Year, and what a year it was last year. Hopefully we can get some football soon, PJ, and we can see how it plays out. It's great to have you back. You know, I appreciate the relationship. Always good to talk to you, PJ. Thanks so much. Stay elite.
Always honored being on the show, Jim. Thanks a lot. Row the boat, Sky. Bob, go Gophers. Thanks.
So I can officially say we are now inside 1 month until the big show. In the lead up to the main event, I've been profiling the field so you know exactly what you're in store for come June 19th. So far, I've done deep dives on Leff and Laguna, Caleb in Green Bay, Rick in Buffalo, Mark in Hollywood, Jeff from Southfield. Today, I'm going to throw it back. Throw it back to a guy who has legendary status around here, a guy who frankly needs no introduction, a guy that you can name just by hearing him say, my name.
Jim, if you'll indulge me for a brief moment. Jim. Thank you for your time, Mr. Jim Rome.
That is the immortal voice of one Jeff. From Richmond, your 2002 Smack-Off champion. A guy whose Smack-Off career started 2 decades ago, but has not been heard from on game day since 2011. None of that matters because once a champ, always a champ. And in 2018, Jeff from Richmond came back from a hiatus that was so long, I legitimately thought that he was gone. Like, gone, gone. But shame on all of us for ever thinking that because he came back, not the day of. Well, he did come back the day of, but didn't make it on day of. But he came back in season. And he came back with an epic 5-minute call that was nearly perfect until he produced an all-time drop by flubbing my second son's name in hilarious fashion.
Or Jake and Rogan. Rome helping revive the Rat family.
War Jake and Rogan. Rome
helping revive the Rat family.
Rogan Lome. Besides that minor hiccup, Jeff from Richmond was everything that we all remembered on that call. And trust me when I say this, no one is more polarizing than this guy. No one. Just like nobody gets more reaction when this guy calls, even to this day. The tweets and emails flood the studio whenever we hear from Jeff. Half of the reaction is glowing praise for a legend. The other half is pure, uncut, unmitigated, unadulterated hate from clones who wish that he really was gone. Gone, and never came back. But if you ask Jeff himself, and he will tell you everybody loves him.
The outpouring of love and affection and respect, Jim, from the biggest gaggle of misfits in the history of sports talk radio. Jim, it's been overwhelming. Not one negative comment.
Not one. Not only does Jeff insist that you all love him, he also insists that the brass around these parts love him as well.
The CBS suits in their microfiber polyester attire have gravitated to Jeff from Richmond at an alarming rate, Jim. And I don't know if you heard the recent remarks, Jim, by CBS Sports VP of Operations Tyler Hale, Jim. They went something like this. Well, Jim, that new clone, that Jesse from Richmond, is quite a rascal, and I'm really looking forward to hearing Jesse call in at the Jim Rome SmackDown on July the 20th.
Dude, none of the suits in New York sound like that. Tyler Hale especially does not sound like that. But the fact that he pulled that guy's name was unbelievable. Jeff is more known for hyping himself than he is for taking runs at other people. He's too busy hyping himself to concern himself with other people. But that doesn't mean that he can't, and it doesn't mean that he won't. He once famously went in on the women of Southern California in an epic rant that still will not be forgotten.
To all the SoCal Insta-skanks that are desperately trying to build their quote-unquote brands on social media, hey, skanks, do us all a favor. Stop digitally altering and enhancing your images on social media. Stop injecting massive amounts of collagen and Botox into your grills and your pie holes. Stop pounding out your beaks multiple times. Stop augmenting your racks 3 and 4 times to achieve, quote, perfect symmetry. And most importantly, skank, stop laying down with every dude you meet just because he drives a slick sled and has a big roll of cake in his pocket. Give me the grace and the dignity of the women from the South 6 days a week and twice on Sunday. And by the way, Jim, if you take a SoCal skank that's an 8 in the great state of California and you drop her into the Commonwealth of Virginia, Jim, the 804, she immediately becomes a 3.
It's incredible. Jeff from Richmond is a walking, talking, professional wrestling promo. And it is incredible. No one plays the character of unabashed, arrogant, braggadocious, blowhard better than Jeff. And he loves it. He loves it as much as you all will hate it. I don't know if this guy shows up on the 19th or not. I just know that the Smack Off was created with people like that in mind. Put simply, Jeff in Richmond was born for this event.
Jim, thanks for the vine, and thanks for the time. The dirtiest player in the game has come back to the Jim Rome Show. Why is Jeff from Richmond so serious about becoming Jim the two-time Smack Off champion? Because that's how I roll. My exclusive private driveway. I was looking out, Jim, at my 6 luxury sleds, sparkling clean, freshly polished, and perfectly aligned. And I know the 2 words that come to mind immediately, Jim, when you think of Jeff from Richmond are humble and modest. Or Matt from L.A. struggling to be relevant in this here jungle. Here's the new protocol in my jungle, Matt, and that is this. When my name goes up, Matt, your mouth goes shut. Jeff from Richmond has established himself as the only legitimate sports radio god. King Kong ain't got nothing on me. This is my yard. This is my house. And clones, trust me, I'm not coming to take part. I'm coming to take over. And until next time, Jim.
Good night now! He is Tim Layden. Tim, it's great to have you back. And before we get into what I consider this great piece that you've done on NBCSports.com right now, how are you and everybody around you, Tim, doing during this pandemic?
We're good, Jim. We live in New England in a fairly rural area, so we've been lucky. We can get out, we can ride bikes, go for a run, got some crappy free weights that have been lying around for years, so it's been okay. We're luckier than a lot of people, and nobody real close to me has gotten real sick, so I'm thankful for that.
Very good. Tim Layden is joining us. Now, Tim, you've been covering sports for decades. Normally, you and I, if we're talking in May, we're talking about the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. What's it been like to not have sports to cover for the past 2 months?
It's been, probably, Jim, the same way it is for a lot of people. You know, it's like there's nothing to do at night for watching. But for me, it's also, you know, during the day when you're looking for things to write about, you got to go way outside the box and think about things that happened a long time ago or things that may happen a long time in the future or how this situation with the virus is impacting sports. And, you know, thinking outside the box is always good, but it does get old. And, you know, I think like everybody else, I'm ready to have something that's current to write about instead of things that are hypothetical or old. And, you know, but you got to be patient at the same time.
We're talking to Tim Layden. Now, the piece on NBCSports.com has the headline, "Sports are coming back, but they'll never be the same." And you open it by writing about the image of Michael Jordan walking off the court after the 1998 Eastern Conference Finals. You have fans leaning out trying to get high five. What was it about that image that caught your attention?
It was just, you know, Jim, I don't think any of us would have thought any of it in any other time, but it just, I knew I was working on this story, and like everybody else, I was watching the Jordan doc every Sunday night, you know, wire to wire. And I saw that image, and he was coming off, and it was all these people, old people, young people, men, women, holding their hands out into the tunnel. And we've all seen like a million shots of athletes walking either down a tunnel to a field or back through a tunnel to the locker room. And it's a really common sports image, but I just thought, you know, we're not going to be able to do that anymore, not in the near future. And, you know, the question I tried to answer is, are we ever going to be able to do that again? And how are athletes going to feel about it? And it just looked to me like something that looked like a time capsule. I just thought, nobody can see around the corner of this situation we're in. You know, we can guess and we can interview people, but my gut feeling was that you're just not going to see an athlete reach up and high five a spectator walking off the court ever again. Athletes are germophobes. They take care of themselves. And I just think we've all learned that that's one area of risk that can be cut out. Mm. And that's what it looked like to me.
We're talking to Tim Layden. Tim, you also made the point that we need sports, but at the same time, it's also important to ask the question, if we do need sports, is it because it's a useful exercise? Or lay that out for me. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I meant was, you know, I mean, I make my living in sports. You make your living in sports. We not only want it, we kind of need it.
Right.
And really need it. But you go one step away from us to someone who's just a fan, I'm sure they feel like they need it too. And it's a big part of all our lives. But I do think, like, every day as I've been working on things and trying to figure out when sports are going to come back and other things to write about, I found myself thinking, you got to be careful here because a lot of people have died. And a lot of people have had to change their lives. And it's been this incredible disruption to everybody in America and a lot of places in the world. And I just think it's useful to sit back and say, man, I really would like to see the rest of the NBA season. I really want to know if the Lakers can win this thing. But at the same time, I just think that for anybody who's a really avid sports fan, there's a lot of value in stepping back every once in a while and saying, you know, how important is it really? You know, like just, and I'm not saying it isn't a big deal, because it is, but at the same time, I just think it's good to, no pun intended, take our temperature once in a while and figure out, you really want to see this stuff, but what's important right now? And both things can be true. Sports can be important and other things can be more important. And that's, I'm just trying to keep my own finger on that pulse all the time.
It's really interesting, isn't it, Tim? Like, for instance, after this happened, sports were not important. And then it seems like they were more important, but you're right. We need to keep our finger on the pulse and decide just how important. You were part of the coverage of sports before and after September 11th. In what ways does this feel similar, and in what ways is it different in your mind?
To me, there's two big ways, Jim. The first is, I mean, terrorism won't ever end. It's always going to be a part of the world. It's been that way for centuries. But 9/11 as an event ended. You know what I mean? It was over, and then we could go on. You could take your anger and your grief and all those things and channel them into the world, knowing that we were trying to do things to prevent this from happening again. But that singular event ended. It hasn't ended. It's changed, and it's interpreted different ways, and maybe we're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel, but we're worried about what might happen next winter. So it's just kind of doggedly pursuing us. And so that's a huge difference. The other difference is, as we try to, and this is more, you know, more of a third rail thing, as we're trying to figure out how to go forward with this, we're not all on the same page. In 9/11, we were all on the same page. We all knew, let's get together, let's wave the flag, let's realize that our country's been attacked, and we got to get together on this. And whatever that takes, that's what we'll do. With this one, we're not all in agreement with what it takes. And, you know, Americans as a country do really well when we're all on the same page, but when we're not on the same page, it's harder to move forward and figure out what the best steps are. And when we're fighting with each other, sometimes that's a really good thing because it gets us to creative places, and sometimes it's tricky. I think those are the two biggest differences.
Tim Layton joining us, a writer at large for NBC Sports. So, Tim, Major League Baseball, of course, has developed a 67-page document outlining health and safety procedures that are required or at least recommended to restart the season. When you consider some of the items on that list, like no high fives, they're recommending no showering at the facilities, guys not sitting next to each other in the dugout, how different will the game look? And has that also changed forever?
I think some of it is going to stick. I mean, Jim, honestly, one of the things that this isn't one of the most important things there. I think people can get. I think major league athletes, if they have to go back to the hotel to shower, they're going to get used to that because they did that when they were kids. You know, I mean, we all revert to how sports were when we were kids. That one doesn't seem to be hard. High fives and handshakes, I think. Half the athletes in the world would just as soon get rid of that anyway, because like I said earlier, they kind of know that that's not the greatest thing in the world to do unless it's with people you know and you go wash your hands afterwards. I immediately thought I can't picture a baseball game without people spitting. You know, that one really, right. That one hit me right between the eyes, and it's a small thing, but you know, it jumped out at me. Like, I don't know how you legislate that out of baseball or almost any sport, but I do think that a lot of those changes that are for now, you know, fans are going to come back. We don't know when or how, but fans will come back. But things like handshaking and high fives and the stuff, you know, with fans, you know, like moving up to the side of the dugout and posing for a selfie with a family, or at football training camp posing for selfies with 100 fans. Maybe it's going to be a personal choice for athletes, but I just see athletes saying, I know that there's more risk in this than I realize. And I'm just going to easily cut that out of my routine. And I think in that way, that's going to look different. And I think we'll get used to it.
So Tim, does that mean that the autograph is also done?
Maybe. There might be ways around that, you know, like one doctor suggested, you know, make sure the athlete keeps his own Sharpie, you know, don't take a pen or a Sharpie from somebody else. But then you're also in that situation where the athlete is like, you know, 6 inches from hundreds of fans and they're breathing on each other. And again, I think we'll back off and go more towards normal, but I don't think we'll go all the way back. That's the thing that's uncertain, but the experts I talked to said that some of them have worked with major league teams and organizations, and they've pretty well decided that kind of heavy, real close personal interaction between fans and athletes or fans and coaches is just something it's just going to move back. And whether it goes away entirely, we just don't know yet. It really could be up to individual athletes, but they're going to realize better now than before that we can make each other sick, and if it's a cold, we can deal with that. If it's a virus that people die from, maybe not. Most things are in the middle, but I just see athletes deciding to mitigate their own risk a little bit.
We're talking to Tim Layden, so it makes you wonder, right, Tim? Like, it's not about you or about me or about our business, but when you look at what you've done over the course of your career, and again, not looking to make it about yourself, but some of the best stories of your career have been very personal in the sense that you had close physical proximity. You had lunch with Usain Bolt in Jamaica. You had dinner with Pat Tillman in Tempe. You visited with Lindsey Vonn. Like, what is it about those conversations that makes them so special, and will you be able to do that going forward?
You know, Jim, you've been interviewing athletes your whole life, too. You know that there's a difference between when, you know, whether it's Chris Long or somebody like that calls into your show, that's a great interview. But, man, there's nothing like sitting next to somebody and having those conversations and getting in a car and going to a workout. And, you know, back when this first started, there was this big thing about media being whiny crybabies that they don't get to go in locker rooms anymore. I mean, I think that's gone for good now, but those little interactions where, you know, I wrote in that column that I ate a meal with Michael Phelps and with Pat Tillman 18 years apart, basically on the same footprint in Tempe. It's a different place because Tempe's been totally bulldozed and rebuilt in the interim, but, you know, both of those interviews were just incredible because I was sitting like 18 inches from somebody who was really interesting. And you can't get that on a phone, and you can't get that on Skype, and you just, it's just not the same. And I hope it doesn't go away. I hope there's a way to make those things continue. Not because I want people to love the media, but, you know, those are the kind of stories that people really appreciate. And, you know, we're people that want to be around other people, and I just hope we can preserve some of that. But I do think there's going to be a period here for weeks, months, or years where everybody's a little sketchy about that, and they probably should be, but I hope some of that comes back.
You're so right. Tim Layden joining us. Tim, before you go, you mentioned Pat Tillman. As you think back to Pat and you think about the time you spent with Pat, what do you remember most about that time you spent with Pat?
Just that Pat lived life with no filter. You know, Pat, I asked Pat questions that he didn't have to answer, and he answered them straight up. And I asked him questions about his physical abilities, and he didn't exaggerate. He was self-deprecating where he needed to be, and he was confident where he needed to be. And he was just a no BS human being, Jim. And there's like a really small number of those in the world. And when you have a chance to be around somebody like that, it never leaves you. And that's why every time I see Pat's name somewhere, it just makes me feel fortunate to have known the guy and sad that he's not with us anymore.
You know, Tim, he was so larger than life. I feel so naive, but I've made this statement a number of times. I always assumed he would come back. I always assumed that he would return home. I didn't think that he would necessarily tell us about the experience entirely or the thought process, but I always assumed he would come back, and it was just such a naive thing to think. Do you remember what you thought or what crossed your mind when you heard he had been killed?
I was just kind of the same thing because I wondered why he went as far as he did to leave the world of the NFL and the money he was. I mean, I kind of knew why, but I wondered, there's so many ways that Pat could have changed the world without putting on that uniform and picking up that gun and going into what he went into in Afghanistan. But that was the way he worked. And just like you, I thought, well, he's going to come back and he's going to do amazing things. And he's just got to get through this. And he was Superman, and Superman, you know, Superman doesn't die like that. And, you know, and I've come to know people that were with Pat when all that happened. And, you know, it's just such a huge shame the way it all went down, and it would have been horrible no matter how it happened. But I just, for a guy that I didn't know that well, but you didn't have to catch what he was about. I just missed that the guy's not with us.
You know, I've been trying to make that point similar to that, Tim, for so many years, and I think that you made it better than I ever have. Before I let you go, let me come full circle. There's no way you can come on in May, and you and I can't talk horse racing at all. So, Tim, what do you make of the revamped Triple Crown schedule this year? Because within the sport, there's already been very energetic reaction to that. What are your thoughts?
I mean, there's no Triple Crown this year. It's just three races that have those same names, and I think the Derby will remain a big deal this year, although it's going to have an asterisk because it's not in May. The Belmont isn't the Belmont. It's just a, it's like the Peter Pan or some other Belmont race, and it's fine. And I wish they had gone to a mile and a quarter. I don't know why they had to pull all the way back to a mile and an eighth. And the Preakness is just a race that follows the Derby. And I hope they're all successful. Maybe they can have some fans, but it's you call it a Triple Crown, but you know, don't call it the Triple Crown, because it's not. And that's okay. This year's different. Everybody's making compromises in their life that are much bigger than rearranging some horse races, but it's not the Triple Crown. It's something different, and maybe next year we get back to something more normal.
I'm trying to let you go, Tim, but if it's not the Triple Crown, and I agree with you, it's not the Triple Crown, but if it's not the Triple Crown, then would a World Series in an 82-game season not be a World Series? Would an NBA championship in a shortened season not be an NBA championship? I guess we should have these things before we consider these things, but how should we see these things?
Well, I mean, I think we've had shortened season in strike shortened and other labor things that have shortened, and we still have a World Series, like you said. We still declare an NBA champion. But I think the Triple Crown is different, because what makes it the Triple Crown is partly the season of the year, because these are young horses still learning to run. So it's a huge ask of them to go a mile and a quarter in Kentucky in front of 160,000 fans, come back in 2 weeks and go a mile and 3/16 in Baltimore, 120,000 fans, and then go to Belmont and go a mile and a half 3 weeks later. It's the spacing and the timing of those three races that make it special. And when you mess with that, it's just, if you change the distances or something like that, then maybe you give them some leeway. But, you know, circumstances have ruled what they could do here, and it's out of their hands. But once you change that timing, Jim, and it doesn't build to the Belmont to a mile and a half in June, it's something completely different. It's not a shortened NBA season. It's like no NBA season at all. It's not the same, and I just don't think you can make that comparison. It's just not. It's too different. It's too far beyond what the norm to call it a Triple Crown.
Agreed. If it's safe and it's right and you run the races, that's fine. Bring it back, but don't call it a Triple Crown, because that's not what that is. He is the excellent, excellent writer at large for NBC Sports. Very good friend of the program. He is Tim Layden. Tim, I appreciate you so much. Stay safe. Really good to have you on the show, Tim. I hope we can do it again really soon.
Thanks, Jim. You too.
Good night now!